to wade into controversy, shame. Controversy is certainly not to take a side in controversy. If one wants to come at the issue we're talking about from the perspective of Psak, so Baruch Hashem, our yeshiva has great poskim far more qualified to address that. And if you want to come at it from the perspective of policy, so certainly the yeshiva has policymakers far more equipped to do that. We're just going to look a little bit at some of the background of the sugya of the question of where does one light menorah when one doesn't have a clearly established residence in the normal sense, and perhaps more specifically, if one is in a yeshiva dormitory or an environment similar to that, where there are different rooms that could possibly qualify, the different areas that could possibly qualify as the place of lighting, where exactly should that take place? And as you're all aware, it is a controversial issue. And again, our intent is just to give a little bit of background about that. And I hope, at least from the conceptual perspective, we can take an attitude of Elu Ve'elu Divrei Elokim Chayim, that all of the opinions, and there are many, as you'll see, that are expressed on this issue are Torah and have their own inherent validity. And that's true in general when we talk about a machlokas, that there could be many different opinions, but they're all opinions that are worthy of being learned. And this sugya in particular, there's one contemporary author who writes exactly that, that there are such a range of opinions, da'avid kamar avid, v'da'avid kamar avid. Familiar with that phrase? It's the Gemara of Maseches Brachos in the fourth parak, where the Gemara says that if one follows this opinion, he's accomplished, and if one follows that opinion, he's also accomplished, he's also fulfilled the mandate. This is an area in which there are various opinions, and within that, there is an extra level of truth to that statement, because some of the various opinions we'll see are expressing preferences rather than absolute conclusions. That's not true across the board. Don't want to misrepresent that. But some of the positions are preferences, and therefore even within their own positions, there's room for other possibilities when forced against the wall, basically, when not all the options are equally open. So just to keep that in mind, hopefully we can have that perspective towards some of these issues, that this is an issue in which there are multiple opinions and can have a respect for all the possibilities. So let me ask you, if you're going to decide where to best light Hanukkah candles, so what factors do you think would be relevant? What do you think would affect this issue?
Whether it's viewable by the public?
Okay, so it should be viewable to a certain extent. So that's one consideration. Noah?
Yeah, I think pursuing.
So then to broaden it, the issue of pursuing Nisa, which is more than what was just said in terms of viewable, maybe it should be a question of where is it most viewable? To what extent is that going to determine things? Anything else? Anything else come up here as a possible issue, Sammy?
Will it stay lit?
Okay, that's a whole other sugya. That's also a concern. That is an issue, but it's a fascinating issue, which is its own self-contained question. Are you yotze if you light in a place where it's essentially impossible for the menorah to stay lit? There's a whole sugya in the beginning of the Hanukkah sugya, which is not our topic for today, where we ultimately conclude that kafsa lo zakukwa, that if the flame goes out, we're not obligated to relight it, but, as the post can point out for various reasons, that's assuming that it was possible for it to remain lit. If you light in such a way that you know going in it's not going to make it, it's not going to make it any requisite amount of time, so then that is a placement concern. But here we're talking just more broadly in terms of where is the right location to begin with. Yes, sir.
Partially your property, shared property.
Okay, so now you're raising a whole different level of issue. We have to figure out in terms of whether your language is appropriate. So, say, is it actually shared or joint property? So one question we have to figure out is how much does property in the ownership sense matter, or does it matter? But you mean literally property?
I mean ownership.
Ownership, you mean literally ownership. So you have to figure out whether that's that's an issue or not. Is there other rubrics to use? Morty? Okay, you can say that. Noah?
Danger in A, the immediate sense of like whether it presents a physical danger or safety hazard, and danger also in the sense of sakana, which is also part of the viewability of junior.
Interesting. The last one in sakana then, how does sakana
like
impact?
In terms of if it was like sakana that you would be endangered if you were like a persecuted location.
I see. Okay, that's an interesting perspective also. So sakana, as we'll discuss, is always a huge issue. And sakana is clearly looming in the background here. But that will come really at the end. That once we try to figure out what our options are, so then sakana will address whether these options really are options. So what do we have so far? So we have issues of pirsum, and we have what Jacob wrote up of issues of property. Now, when it comes to property, we probably have to define it a little differently, right? Because we don't necessarily have an ownership requirement per se. It's an interesting question how much ownership really plays a role, but maybe we could use something a little bit related to that, but maybe a little bit less rigid in a legal sense. But there seems to be a question of what associates with you. That apparently there is a need to be able to identify the location with the person lighting the candles. Where that need comes from is not obvious. We have to try to see if we can figure that out. But there seems to be some such need, and that seems to be driving a lot of the discussions. So within that, let's try to consider a little bit about what we have. Now, the sugyas in Maseches Shabbos, which talk about Hilchos Chanukah, don't really address this issue head on. And most of the terminology that you find, or a little bit of the terminology at least to begin the discussion, is borrowed from Erevin, as John excitedly pointed out. So what terminology do we borrow from Erevin? And what are the possible factors that are invoked there in terms of the question of defining where one would establish an Erev Tchumen from? Morty?
Pita or Makom
Lina? Right, Makom Pita and Makom Lina. Nothing to do with shawarma, but... A general, it sounds like a good name for a shawarma place. It's at least on Chanukah, you'll put up Makom Pita, but light your menorah there. Solve all your problems. But there is a discussion as to what establishes your residence for the purposes of Tchumen, or at least establishes your association for the purpose of Tchumen. And we seem to have two options there. That either it is Makom Pita, meaning the place of Pas, or the place where you eat, or Pas Nish, the Makom Lina, right, the place where you sleep. So there the question comes up as to what exactly is the dominant place, and what seems to emerge really for the purposes of Chanukah after this terminology is imported into that context by the Rishonim, so the earlier sources, what do you really find as the main determinant between these two possibilities, Pita and Lina? What really seems to come up as the main factor? Really, it's Pita. Really, the place of eating seems to be the driving force. You could say there's a hashkafic question here. What's life all about, eating or sleeping? Or some combination of the two. But this Makom Pita really seems to be dominant. And you find there's a statement in the Rush, where the Rush says, the Rush is really talking about somebody who has some kind of a guest arrangement, where he has one house where he's sleeping in, and another house where he's eating in. And there he talks about that if you are eating in one place, you should be lighting there, but you should also light in the place where you're sleeping because of Chshad. And the Rashba, in his Chuvas, quoted by the Beis Yosef, says really to light in the place where you are eating. And they're probably not really arguing. The question is just how much is there a concern of chshad, of suspicion, if you're going to leave your sleeping place unilluminated. So there, yeah.
Wait, chshad, that it's dangerous for you?
No, so chshad is a consideration that's mentioned in the Gemara. We have to figure out how much it's relevant to these circumstances. But the Gemara sometimes invokes the concern that people will suspect you of not lighting the menorah. So specifically, the Gemara talks about that in the context of you have a house that has two doors, and people can't tell which door is the front door. They're both the front door. They both look like they are the front door. So then there's a concern that you have a menorah by one side of the house and not by the other. People will wonder. People will suspect you. So you find there the Gemara says to light in both places. So here you're going to see this is going to be invoked to different degrees in this discussion. So here that's the question. Maybe your main lighting should be really by the place of eating, but there should also be a hadlaka mishum chshad in the place where you're sleeping. We're going to have to discuss just how much chshad is going to play a role in contemporary circumstances in general, and especially within the yeshiva setting. So the Ramah adds that nowadays the practice seems to be clearly where one eats, and that nowadays we're not so concerned about chshad. And the assumption seems to be, we have to figure this out a little bit, that chshad was relevant in the time of the Gemara where they all lit outside their house. And they all lit really at a very prescribed time. So then, if you have a house with a door without a menorah, so then that's going to raise suspicions. But nowadays that we light inside, so it's a question how much this is really a concern. So here this is a little bit of a murky point, because already the Gemara talks about this changing, and yet we don't find the instant disappearance of the chshad consideration. So for example, these Rishonim, the Rush, who invoke chshad, also mentioned that nowadays we light inside, and he's still talking about chshad. So what seems to emerge from that is that in the time of the Gemara, there was this more rigidly defined chshad consideration, that two doors on different sides of the house, al pidin, required two menorahs. Nowadays, we don't necessarily have that kind of circumstance, but we have a more subjectively defined chshad, that when you're associated with a certain residence, and people are going to wonder, what's up, how come there's no menorah there? So then, that's a factor that could subjectively be entered into the conversation, and presumably that's how you have to interpret what the Rush is invoking, because again, the Rush is also writing after the Gemara, when we already know that this situation has changed. So his invoking of chshad, we have to take a little bit in a more subjective sense. Hi.
So doesn't the Gemara bring up the option of lighting on your dining room table?
So right, so that's after the Takana. That's the point that the Gemara already talks about
after
this. Yeah, so that's what the Gemara says. After the Takana, then you can light even inside. So the usage of chshad to say that it just disappears at the time of the Gemara is a little bit difficult. But at the same time, you know, here the Ramah is saying this, so we have to figure out, it seems to have morphed from a more rigid consideration to a more subjective consideration. Okay, so far so good. So we could just take this perspective and say, okay, so that's it. So it's the place where you eat that defines the issue. And therefore, if you're in a yeshiva where you eat in one place and you sleep in another place, so then let's just go with the place of eating. Let's have everyone light in the cheder ochel or something like that. So that's a position one could take, and there were gedolei haposkim such as the Chazon Ish, who's quoted in a number of later svarim, and Yevam Cutler, who took that position, that the dining room is the appropriate place to light, that that's the makom pita for the Bnei HaYeshiva. But there are others who felt that it doesn't totally fit. And here you see this question, first of all, where is their pirsum, and also where is their association being invoked in a little bit more of a complex kind of way. The Minchas Yitzchak, for one, talks about where pirsum is greater. He says, maybe if you have two different rooms in the same building, one room is for Lina, one room is for Pita, and they're essentially comparable in pirsum, that affects the discussion. How do we know whether or not this really parallels what's being described in the Rishonim? And there were poskim who really felt that the cheder ochel is greatly lacking. So among those poskim were Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, who wrote this in a few places. He wrote this in his Tshuva Zigris Moshe. He wrote this in journals that were quoted by others. Later, other poskim who were students of his quoted this, that he's pretty strong, that he thinks that the cheder ochel really is not the best place. Because, says there, everyone just sits wherever they want, and you don't find yeshivas where they have assigned seating by the lunchroom. And even if they did, it wouldn't be something anybody was makbid on. So he was pretty sure that you don't have an association with particular students in the cheder ochel, as opposed to the dormitory, where it's much more connected, even if it's a group of students, two, three, four students in a room, but still it's much more associated with individual students than the cheder ochel is. Now here's just to mention this point. So there is a little bit of a question in terms of how to understand his language, because he is pretty strong about this. He's really confident that the cheder ochel does not match up at all to the dormitory. But still raises the question of, does that mean the dormitory is nothing? Does that mean that the cheder ochel is nothing? So are we talking about preferences, even though he's expressing a very strong preference here? Or is this a way of saying that cheder ochel is absolutely nothing, doesn't even enter as a possibility? So here, that's where there's a little bit of subjectivity, because see, this discussion really revolves around the question of how do you assess what's more your place than the other place. So it's a little hard to know sometimes when one place loses. Does it lose absolutely, or does it lose just when you have both options? But if you didn't have the other option for whatever technical reasons, then maybe the second choice, even if it's a far second, might be something that could re-enter the conversation. So Rav Nosson Gishtetner and his Chuvis and Lahoris Nasan and Chelik Vav, Simon Mem Dalit, so he also has a tshuva for similar conclusions with different approaches. He says he doesn't think that cheder ochel is really something that can be considered your residence, because the way it's set up in the yeshiva system, and the university system perhaps also doesn't discuss that for some mysterious reason, but the way it's set up, at least in the yeshiva system, is that you're only there during the meal time. So if one decided he wanted to hang out and work on his papers in the cheder ochel in the middle of the day, or he wanted to take a nap on the bench in the cafeteria, so presumably he wouldn't be allowed to do that. That the dining hall is only open during the dining hall hours. And therefore, he wants to dress it and have a raya for this far, but he thinks that it seems clear to him that that kind of arrangement means that it's not really your place in the same kind of sense. It's not really a candidate for being your place when you're so limited in your access and it's only during the mealtime hours. He also says that especially during the time of the Hadlaka, it's not necessarily a place where you're hanging out. It's also a little bit subjective. But essentially, that's his preference, similar to Rav Moshe Feinstein, although he articulates it differently for different svaras. But essentially, he takes a very similar position, that theoretically one could have spoken about Makom Pita as the determinant, but in the context of the yeshiva environment, the lunchroom, the dining room, doesn't really have what it takes to qualify as the place. Hi.
What if you're a person that utilizes your cheder ochel a lot, but you never eat meals in your own? You use your dining room like a lot, but you don't use it for meals, because let's say you have to leave so early for work, you don't eat breakfast there.
You have to do what? Sorry.
You have to leave so early for work, you don't eat breakfast there, and you're at work, so you don't eat lunch there, and you get back so late from work, you don't eat dinner there.
So you just take naps there. You use it as the presumably it's your makom lita instead of your. I guess you could turn everything upside down. That would be interesting. You know what defines it as your, just because it happens to be the eating room for everyone else. But it's definitely an unusual kind of situation, which is even less typical than the yeshiva scenario that he's describing. it probably puts you in the Twilight Zone. I mean, I guess if you... It's hard to say it's yours, certainly according to Reb Moshe's Svara, that there's anything that really connects to you. It seems like it's more like a park bench in that kind of scenario. There were those who suggested, the Stipler and Abel Yashiv and others, that perhaps, especially during the time of Hanukkah, you should make sure to take some meals back to your dorm room in order to establish it as both the Mokon Pita and the Mokon Lina. So that's the suggestion you find in some Svarim. Not everyone was so excited about that. So, for example, Reb Moshe Sternbach writes in his Svarim that he doesn't think that's going to make a difference. That essentially, the idea of using the Mokon Pita as the place that is relevant, that's working off the assumption that there is chashivas associated with that, that there's a certain formality that we associate with the dining area. So if you happen to grab some food in your room because you're in a rush or because you're trying to define it differently, that's not really going to do the trick. And this probably is evocative, just to mention briefly, of a comment the believer Sternbach has also in a different context. There is a whole discussion about Halakos Neiros on Yom Kippur, or Halakos Neiros before Yom Kippur, and the question of where one should place the candles for Yom Kippur. So Friday night we have candles. We want to have them near our dinner table because we're eating there. So we want to have the light for the dinner table. But Yom Kippur, so we're not eating there. So what's the point in having them in that area specifically? So it could be, and this is something that Sternbach happens to discuss in that context, that still the dining room table is a place of chashivas. Even if the meal isn't actually taking place then, it doesn't change the fact that there is still significance and formality associated with that, and you're not necessarily going to get that by just taking some meals in your room in an ad hoc basis, and that's how he felt in terms of that suggestion. So, essentially, this is one approach to say that, yes, theoretically, could say, okay, the eating does establish it, like the Chazanish and Rivara Cutler, or you could say that maybe it theoretically could have, but there are quirks about the yeshiva setup that don't lend themselves to that, like Reb Moshe and Reb Nosson Gestetner were maintaining. Or you could say that you could try to somehow combine the two, and that is also a debatable point, whether or not that works. So that gives us a range of shittas in terms of whether it would be the dormitory or the dining room, or somewhere in between. So what about somewhere literally in between, in the position that is essentially that YU has adopted, that there is such a thing as a lobby that can count for Hadlakas Neiros. So this is really based, for the most part, on the Talmudic concept of chatzer, and the idea that the Gemara talks about, perhaps even ideally, lighting in a chatzer. A chatzer in modern usage, we would say a chatzer is like a lobby, a chatzer is like an entryway. So from that perspective, working off the Gemara, it seems to be a basis to say that lighting in a chatzer is at least a viable option. The problem is really the Chazon Ish. The Chazon Ish is quoted in this obsession that Rav Shechter feels is compelling, that we nowadays don't have the chatzer that the Gemara was talking about. That in the time of the Gemara, a chatzer had a different format, and that essentially it was basically like a room of your house, even though it was common to a few families. But the nature of the setup was that you could have a few residences surrounding a given area, and that area was common to all those residences, but people actually used that area as a kind of a common living room or kind of a common backyard or whatever you want to call it, something which they would actually not just pass through on the way into their private residences, but something that actually would be ke'ilu a part of their houses. Hi.
So there's the, let's say, two parts to the room and lobby, if we want to get a little more nitty-gritty.
Okay.
Let's say there's a place that you like walk through, as you said, it's more like, you know, towards the control, or you kind of go downstairs to the cat, and then there's the area where the TV is.
And that's to the left.
Yeah, I mean, that's through the glass doors. You have to go through two glass doors to get there.
Okay.
So would that be a little bit better in terms of the Hazon issues definition? Because, like, plenty of people, let's say, watch TV there and, like, socialize in general.
And so I guess the question could also be, I mean, we'll flesh this out a little bit more, but maybe just one question I'll bring it up could be, so, but who gathers there? People who live in the dorm gather there because it's kind of like their room? Or anybody from... I was there last night because I had some conflicting events and I was trying to get to the Malava Malka also, and I only got there after everyone was gone. I hope you all had a good time. I tried very hard to be there, but I had three conflicts last night. So I am freshly aware of that room. That's the only thing I made it into, and nobody there was the only room that had anybody in it was that room. So it had two people in it. So nobody was anywhere else. So that's how late it was. So who are these two people? And these two people, I didn't ask them. Should have interviewed them in preparation for this question. But are they people who live in the dorm and this is how they come down and hang out there? Or they could have been like me. They could have been walking off the street and found their way into this room also. So that might be relevant. Again, we know it's hard to define it absolutely. But you know, if you say it's like Times Square, where people also gather to watch TV, right? So Times Square would have a different kind of definition. It's not associated with anybody. So we could go too far with this point, that the point that it has to be, presumably, what the Chazon's point was, that it's something which was both private and public, in the sense that it was common to more than one family, but in a sense it was the area that belongs to these three or four families. Who the Chatzar was around, I think. Was it Jacob that Noah was up for?
We also said there's an aspect of in the lobby, technically, the guards are supposed to stop anyone that does not have a YU ID card. So therefore, only people who belong to this Chatzar, who are part of the YU community, are supposed to be able to have access to it.
Which would make it then shyer to the whole YU community.
Also more.
Okay. People from more who are also... Okay,
meaning
it's limited a little bit to who can come in, though.
Right, so again, there's a little bit of subjectivity here, how much that's going to help, because again, this, or would we say that somebody from work could make there also?
Right, and people who are in the apartments around.
Right, or people...
But they're all part of the greater YU community.
Right. I remember once I was walking around the village and I walked into a Cardozo and they let me in because I had a YU ID card. I've never been in the building before. So obviously I feel at home even though I've never been here before. So you know, theoretically, how much would that help? It's a good question. Hi.
So would like a hotel lobby be considered modern day concert?
So there it would be hard, the hotel, because they only let the guests in, or they...
Also,
it probably depends. That question may depend what kind of hotel it is, which, you know, there are different hotels that have different...
It's more expensive.
It's still even within that, there are different types. but there also, the question is, so what exactly do the guests do in the lobby? Still, it might just be that the lobby is just one way to get from one place to another. So there's a lot of subjectivity here. And Rav Asher Weiss, if I recall correctly, so he questions this whole premise of the Chazon Ish, that it should make a difference, because it's okay, so the Chatzeros have changed since the time of the Gemara. But how do we know that that affects us here? How do we know that the halacha of Neres Chanukah that extends to a chatzar was contingent on that kind of usage? Maybe it's still associated enough, even if we don't have the same type. There are a couple of halachos that come up from a chatzar. It affects halachos mezuzah. If you have a chatzar, let's say, in the back of your house, so you're going to need a mezuzah on your back door anyway, because it's the door to your house. But the question, what direction should it go? Is it just you're going into your house over there, or maybe your chatzar is a prominent usage? Maybe you should have the mezuzah on your back door going into the chatzar. So there are other halachos that are affected by the concept of chatzar. So we're not sure, says Rav Asher, just because the usage has changed to a certain degree, does that mean that the whole din disappears? Maybe not. Or does it mean that the possibility of it for Neres Chanukah was contingent on those usages? Not necessarily. Hi.
How about the hallway in the apartment building?
The hallway
in your apartment building.
Is it
closer to a chatzar?
Possibly. I mean, because it's more restricted entry, or because...
it's common to everyone on that floor.
The hallway on the floor specifically,
not
in the lobby. Possibly, yeah. I mean, possibly you have there. Also, especially because if you're going to light in the hallway, then you can light outside your own apartment for the hallway. So then that might be closer to the Pesach Beso kind of model that's associated with your specific apartment.
Uh-huh.
So that has that advantage to it. But the hallway downstairs, so the question is if nowadays the contemporary hallway means that a lobby in the ground floor means that it's just something you pass through on the way to your residence, then that question comes up, is passing through enough, or is the Chazon Ish right here that it had to be more than just passing through, that it was specifically the stake that all of the residents had in this area as usage that made it the viable candidate? So this affects a few issues. There's another aspect. Hi.
Just how does the... There seemed like there was an issue of like heker, like that it has to be known that it's your menorah. So
that's what it sounds like.
Sounds like something. So if you're lighting in the lobby, then nowadays, I mean, it doesn't seem like anyone would know that spot on the table is yours.
Yes, that's also a question. We'll discuss that in a little bit more detail in a few minutes, because again, this is a very undefined concept, as we'll see a little bit more about. But I wonder if it means they have to be able to specifically say, okay, this is Jacob's menorah, or the idea that we know that, okay, this is Jacob's residence and there's a menorah here, so maybe there's a few people here, and there are five people here, and there are five menorahs. Okay, that much we can handle. Right, again, there's so much subjectivity here, but I guess the limit would be probably like Ramosha was implying in the cafeteria, where it becomes completely detached from any possibility of associating anything with anybody, because it's all a hodgepodge. And it sounds like he was basically saying that the cafeteria is already like outside in the Rosh Hashanah, because nothing has any association with anybody. Where do you draw the line? It's a big question, which also brings to my earlier question of, are we dealing with absolutes or are we dealing with preferences here? Because it's not so clear. So these are there's an additional suggestion that there might be one key word that might differentiate the dormitory lobby from other possible chatzeros in a positive way, so in a positive way to make the dormitory lobby more viable. And that one word is pajamas. So do people walk around in their pajamas in this area? So if they do, so then one can make a greater case that that really is considered to be like a somewhat private residence, assuming that people don't walk around that way in the streets. So where this kind of defines things differently, and they don't either walk that way either in the street or in the base medrash, so this somehow gets status as an area which is pajama viable. So there are those who suggest that that might make it more of the kind of chatzer than otherwise might be, and perhaps even within the Chazon Ish as far, maybe there's room to say that the dormitory setting might be a little different. So there are a couple of other factors here just to raise just for the next few minutes. So one major question to consider is just how much of an issue is this whole discussion? In other words, just to what degree are the students of the yeshiva chayiv in their own hadlaka? So there is a strong possibility that many felt was the case. And Rabbi Yosef has a truth about this, but it goes even farther, that the question is only relevant on the level of Mahadran. That as far as the Ikar Mitzvah, so a case could be made that either most or all of the Bnei HaYeshiva are Yotzei the Ikar Mitzvah through someone else. So who else? So either their parents at home, but this is really the din of Ner L'Kol Echad V'Echad, which is the Mahadran, which is the second level, but the Ikar Mitzvah of Ner Yishuv Eso, that they fulfill through their parents. Or, there's also the possibility that they fulfill it through the Rosh Yeshiva, or the Mashkiach, or someone, if there is some dominant personality who's associated with the institution, who's lighting, that also could fulfill the obligation on behalf of the Bnei HaYeshiva. And that's the position that Ravadja takes. He says that's the minig among the Sfardim, that there really is no need for the Bnei HaYeshiva to be lighting their own menorahs from that perspective.
But two, I guess, considerations. One is, like, most Rosh HaYeshiva, like, I guess for us, like, the Rosh HaYeshiva doesn't live in Yeshiva. So,
right, so because he was talking about a slightly different model, I was talking about a singular figure who represents the whole institution. You have to figure out exactly who that is, but presumably there is somebody we can identify. But without that, we have the first bar that the parents are lighting at home, and that also should seem to knock things down to the level of Mahadrin. There are those who question, as a sefer called Shalmei Toda. He has a whole essay where he explains why he doesn't think that that's really the case. But there are many who feel that that's true, that we're dealing already on the level of Mahadrin. So as far as the Ikra Mitzvah of Hanukkah, the students are already Yotzei, and that this is a next level kind of question. So that's a possibility. It's also interesting to note the tshuvas of Rabadi, who always has something a little different. He's an independent kind of thinker. So in his tshuvas, Ori Yitzchak, in the second chelek, he has a brief tshuva, where he quotes Rav Moshe Feinstein's tshuva that we mentioned at the beginning. And he questions it. He says, where did this whole idea come from? That it has to be your place, it has to be your place in the dining room. As we mentioned, it's somewhat subjective. And again, as I mentioned, also everybody is an independent thinker. Since he doesn't know where you find such a requirement. And he doesn't think that it's true. And then he goes on to say a bigger chiddush, that he thinks, and there are others who say like this also, that he thinks that the whole idea that there were these requirements of where the menorah should be lit, you find often the terminology based on Rishonim and developed as its own kind of sugya, that menorah chovas habayis, that a menorah really associates with the household. And that's what seems to be driving this whole conversation, that we have to figure out what is your household. So that, he assumes, that changed. That was before the takana. But once they said, no longer are you lighting outside, but you're lighting inside, so then it became essentially a chovas haguf. It used to be a chovas habayis. It used to be that it was a household mitzvah. But now it is something that you do as an individual. So that comes out. This is also something that's very typical of Rabbani's positions on a lot of issues. Comes out l'kula and l'chumra. Comes out l'kula that you can basically light anywhere. But it also comes out that it's harder to rely on anyone else's lighting, especially if you're not present. If you're present, maybe that's a different story. But to say that somebody else could be motzi you when you're not there, if you take away the chovas habayis kind of svara, it becomes more difficult to say. There is also an interesting essay in the Sefer Gevuras Yitzchak. Gevuras Yitzchak is the title of a number of svarim that are written by Yitzchak Sirotskin, who's a prominent Rosh Hashiva in the Lakewood area. He is the grandson of our frequently quoted Parsha Shir Sefer, the Aznayim LaTorah, the Luskarav. But more relevant to this, he was the son of the Luskarav, the son of Rufal Baruch Sirotskin, who was the Rosh Hashiva in Tells in Cleveland. So he discusses in his Sefer the practice in Tells, and the practice there, that they just lighten the base medrash and remote see everyone through that. So how does that work? So he assumes that it's basically midin lighting in shul, lighting in the basic knesses. But then the question becomes, so we normally assume that when you light in the basic knesses, you're not yotzei, your own personal chiyuv. You still have to go home and light as well. So he has a discussion of some of the possibilities of why that is. What exactly is the role of lighting in the Beis HaKnesses, which is a minig, but it's a minig that we make a bracha, it's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch. There's a whole discussion of what is it supposed to fulfill. Is it comparable, perhaps, to making Kiddush in Shul? That's an interesting discussion in of itself, why we make Kiddush in Shul nowadays. So, just very briefly, we make Kiddush in Shul for a couple of possibilities. One possibility from the time of the Gemara is to be motzi those who don't otherwise have Kiddush, and it's a whole discussion whether that has any relevance today. Another possibility is it's a type of pirsum that we want to make a statement that we don't just make Kiddush at home, we also make Kiddush in the public place in shul. So both of these might be relevant to Neris Hanukkah, that maybe it is to be mostly those who don't otherwise light. They have to figure out how that works. It's all separate sugya, or maybe it's a different level of piersum. That's one thing to light at home, and then it's another thing to light in this public gathering place, which brings things up a notch. So there are other possibilities as well, but you have to figure out how that could be enough if we're normally not relying on that in our communities when we light in shul, so we still go home and light again. So why should it be enough here? So part of that gets to the question of why it is that we have to light at home. Is it because lighting at home is chovas habayis and it's not your bias in the shul? And then we have to figure out to what extent is that really relevant here. Another possibility, as he discusses, is that maybe it's really because of chshad, that same concern, that maybe we could have been yotzei in shul, but chshad means that we also have to light at home. And then the question is, so what are the ramifications of that? Does that mean that if you don't fulfill this chshad requirement, you're not yotzei at all? Or that that's just a reason to do an extra havaka, but you theoretically are yotzei on some level, even without the chshad fulfillment? No?
Well, why would there be a chashad if everyone's letting it take the shul?
So because people don't necessarily see you in shul, they just see your house. They don't know exactly what's going on in the shul.
But if the assumption is that there's a communal letting in the shuls, then...
If that's how it's related to, right? And that's an interesting question. So that, whether that svara is helpful for shul, what seems to be relevant to us also is that it should be helpful at least for the yeshiva setting. So whatever concerns of chshad that you have, and the post can do involve them in the yeshiva context also, but there seems to be a strong svara to say that, let's say theoretically, if you have a yeshiva policy that doesn't allow anybody to be lighting in the dormitories, so it's hard to say that there's going to be any chshad of you because of that, because everyone knows that that's the rules, that that's the policy. So why should anyone question why you're not lighting in the dorm when no one's lighting in the dorm, because that's the yeshiva policy? So despite the fact that in some contexts you do find this invoked, it would seem pretty compelling that when there is a policy that the chshad svar shouldn't apply, and no one would have any reason to question why you're not lighting in the dormitories. And it's also crucial to point out that the policies are serious policies, that the issue of fire and associated terrible risk is a very real one. And yeshivas in America throughout the decades have unfortunately suffered multiple terrible fires because of candles in the dormitory. And very often the policies have changed after that. I believe that was the case in Tells also. I think Tells in Cleveland, if I remember correctly, was one of the yeshivas that had a terrible fire, and then change the policy afterwards. So as we know, sakana is a tremendous factor, and also the policy of the institution, together with that, also creates a prohibition of gezel, when their property is used not in accordance with whatever the rules are. And sakana also means that when there is an issue because of sakana, so it's not up to the individual to decide, well, I can do it, it's not going to be dangerous, and I'll manage things. Sakana, by its very nature, has to be observed across the board by everybody. This is something that Rav Asher Weiss discusses in a different context, but it's presumably relevant here as well. So he discusses the question of lighting on an airplane. So bottom line, some quick advice, don't try this at home. And especially don't try this away from home on an airplane. You should not light Hanukkah candles on an airplane for so many different reasons. But among the reasons that he discusses there, says that it's established as a sakana, and you can't say, well, all right, I can do it and I'll manage it, and it won't be a sakana, because if you can't have everyone do it, then no one can do it. That's part of the nature of what a sakana is. And, as you notice there also, there's issues of gezel and other related principles, besides the fact that you're not going to be yotzei anyway, because it's immediately going to be extinguished before they take you off the jail. So that's relevant to what Sammy brought up before, that if it's not going to last because it's too windy, so this should be comparable to that, and it's not even going to be an effective lighting. So essentially, the main issue that he and other posts can mention in that context, and we're not really discussing this topic now, but just using it for comparison, is that somebody who is traveling and who doesn't have family members at home will pay life for him, so that, okay, so perhaps that person doesn't have a bias, that if we do hold on to the idea of kovos habayis, so then essentially you'd be pater, and there isn't any way to do it. Now, would Rabbani agree with that? If he says it's not tied down to bias anymore, probably not. But if you're on the plane all night, you don't have any other options, so then you're essentially honest. You don't have any possibilities, so you should be pater according to him as well. But the basic point being that policies of yeshivas which don't allow lighting in dormitories have to be taken very seriously, both mishum gezel, both mishum sakana, both mishum policy, and they, by their very nature, also make a case that, first of all, chashad should not be an issue, and also that if we do assume that we're talking about preferences, and again, not every posik is working off that perspective, some are assuming that other options are just simply not options, but if we're talking about preferences, so then once the number one on the list is ruled out because of some kind of related issue, then it makes number two into the preference, as long as it's something which at least is a part of the discussion. Okay, so those are, again, some of the background issues to this complex and thorny topic. So just to quickly review the highlights of what we spoke about. So we talked about how, in general, there is a question whether pita or lina is the dominant factor in assessing somebody's key residence. When it comes to menorahs, so we find from the Rishonim and the Ramah that there seems to be a preference for makom pita, for the place where you eat, but whether or not that carried over into a cheder ochel preference in the yeshiva environment was a topic of machlokes. Some poskim said yes, other poskim said no, the cheder ochel is too limited or too disassociated from any individual student or other objections, and therefore the sleeping place would be preferable. Some said bring food into the sleeping place to be mekayim shnehem. Others said that wouldn't help, it would still be lacking the formality of the dining room. And then we discussed also the possibility of chatzer, which is apparently the position adopted here, and the question of whether chatzer continues to exist b'zman hazeh. The Chazon Ish is objection that our chatzeros are no longer utilized the same way, but Rav Asher Weiss and others offering, well, maybe so, but how do we know that affects the laws of Hanukkah? And we discussed also the pajamas, for whether that would perhaps make a difference. We also talked about whether there is a chiyuv maker hadin for Bnei Yeshiva to light, or the yotzei maker hadin, either with parents or with the Rosh Yeshiva, and therefore the whole discussion is only on the level of Mahadrin. Then we spoke also about Rabbi Badi Svara, that nowadays there is no more location rules because of the sakana when it was moved inside. It's basically just a chovah sagavra. And talked also about Mr. Sorotskin's discussion about the policy of Tellus and many other issues, just to light in the base measure, how he compares that to lighting in shul, and yet nonetheless feels that that could still be a viable option for the yeshiva students, and why that is. And again, we emphasize the tremendous importance of being careful of issues of sakana and gezel, and not taking it upon oneself to decide what policies are valid, what policies aren't valid, but to recognize the tremendous significance that lies behind such policies, and hopefully we're able to take an attitude of Eilu Be'eilu Divrei Elokim Chaim, and that should help us to have a safe and happy